Hello everyone and welcome to Heart Yoga Radio. We are on episode 19 of our Tao Te Ching series. And today we're going to be reading chapter 32. We're having a walk along the beach today, so you'll probably hear quite a lot of sea sounds in the background as we march across the sand. Nobody around, so it's a lovely time to do this. Anyway, so over to you.
The Tao has no name. It is a cloud that has no shape. If a ruler follows it faithfully, then every living thing under heaven will say yes to him. Heaven and earth make love, and the sweet dew rain falls. The people do not know why, but they are gathered together like music. Things have been given names from the beginning. We need to know when we have enough names. This is wisdom. At the beginning of time, the sage gave names to everything, seen and unseen. A ruler who walks the way is like a river reaching the sea, gathering the waters of the streams into himself as he goes.
Sounds nice.
Well, it's a change of register again.
Yeah.
We're all about war and rulers and politics and...
We are a little bit into the ruler again now.
It's always the ruler. It's always about the ruler and it's always about the sage. Either being the ruler or the advisor of the ruler. You know, there's always this combination of mysticism and politics. And I suppose this is the same in that respect, but the emphasis here is on the Tao, and on how the Tao can influence the sage, who can then be a good ruler or a good advisor of a ruler through the acquaintance with the Tao. So he's gone a little bit cosmic in this one. It's just the way to put it. You know, he's gone away from all this down-to-earth stuff about war and just nipped over into the cosmic. And here we go. He's trying to F the ineffable, of course. The Tao has no name. So immediately the paradox of trying to F the ineffable is right in our face. The Tao has no name. It's got no name, but he's called it something. He's called it the Tao. But there's a definite point here. It's about not letting us turn our metaphysical commitment into tyranny. If the Tao has no name, if we don't even know what to call it, yet we insist on being guided by it, we can't absolutize it. We can't turn it into a cudgel to browbeat people into following our will. It'd take us very far afield here to do what I'm just about to say, but you can track fascism to metaphysical certainty. And it's particularly apparent in Plato's Republic. But so that's a bit of a side trip for us to go off down that one. It seems like Lao Tzu sees that. I mean, he's aware of some bigger picture. He's aware of some fundamental principle through a meditative acquaintance with things, the flow of things. But he's not willing to let that become an excuse for tyranny. The Tao has no name, it is a cloud that has no shape. So it's ungraspable, it's intangible, it's ineffable. He still tries to F the ineffable because he has to speak. It's an essential poetic core of the human tragedy and comedy that we can't F the inevitable, but we have to try. And I think getting your head around that is incredibly useful on a personal level, if we've been able to get by in life without making heavy weather of stuff.
did.
We have to try the impossible and the most impossible, and yet the most demanding on us to attempt it. I think that is our situation, and I think there's a great beauty in that as well, to be honest with you. It goes on, there's the dough, we can't pin it down, but a ruler has to follow it. We can't pin it down, but you've got to follow it. If you're going to rule, if you're going to be some kind of leader, if you're going to determine the future for a community, and this does happen, people get thrown into that position. Some people inherit it. Some people want it. But yeah, communities are such that very often an individual or a few individuals determine its future. And so this is where, you know, the ruler is just basically somebody who's in a position for whatever reason to be able to determine the future, or to be compelled to try to determine the future of a community. A good ruler, and all of Lao's stuff about rulers is about what a good and successful ruler who can look after the people, care for the people, follows the Tao faithfully, but the Tao won't be pinned down. Yeah, so you've got a ruler who's going to follow the Tao faithfully, but they're not going to, they know they can't pin it down. And this is what sobers a ruler. People who can exert social power with that in mind are not likely to become tyrants. Tyranny comes out of the certainty that isn't warranted around some particular metaphysical principle. It's that which allows people to burn women at the stake because they're witches. It's that which enables leaders to incarcerate their opponents in terrible conditions. And Lao Tzu just sees how you can avoid that here. But he does note that if somebody is acquainted with the Tao, that they're also very persuasive. It enables them to lead, to be community leaders with a certain ease and grace. If a ruler follows the Tao faithfully, then every living creature under heaven will say yes to him. So there it is. You know, it's very, there's just what, four or five lines there, and it's a complete political philosophy in four or five lines. And then goes on, and he offers an ancient cosmology. And we've talked about this on numerous occasions in respect of the Samkhya, in respect of medieval alchemy, in respect of Mysterium Conjunctionis and so forth, Hermeticism. And of course, Taoism is quite willing to utilise this same ancient duality of male and female out of some sexual embrace producing the world. And there it's heaven and earth. Heaven and earth make love. And the sweet dew rain falls. Rain is like grace. There's a grace which falls down. The people do not know why. Nobody knows why, oddly. Sage might have an inkling. Ordinary people are concerned with the shopping and fixing the garden and painting the walls and doing the cooking. And they don't have time to reflect on it. Maybe don't have the inclination to reflect on it, but there's a few nutters who do. And what do they perceive? Heaven and earth make love and the sweet rain falls. But they are gathered together like music. I mean, really, that's very, very cryptic, but it's about a community that feels at ease. And for when there's peace and things are working along nicely, the harvests are coming in, and things are ticking over, and there's this bucolic peacefulness that Lao Tzu is so fond of and which he recommends. When you have that situation, societies are very harmonious. The people gather together like music. There's this harmony. So he's throwing that out in front of us as well. He's kind of juxtaposing these things. They seem a little bit unconnected, but they're not. He's painting a picture, is what he's doing. And then, very interestingly, there's this concern for language all of a sudden. And this is most pregnant at this historical time, if you're alert to the linguistic turn in Western philosophy. And the concern in the 20th century, the middle of the 20th century, with language and naming. And this is what Lao Tzu says. And I'll say for me, she's amazingly resonant and pregnant. Things have been given names from the beginning. Well, of course, we name things. But we need to know when we have enough names. This is wisdom. And what I glean from that is that, well, of course, the development of language at the very, very earliest times in human history was absolutely crucial to the development of human society, the development of technologies, the development of social organisations of many types, the adaptability of human beings to all kinds of conditions on planet Earth. And they are everywhere, almost. Well, now they are everywhere, aren't they? Now that people live at the South Pole, even. And the evolution of language and the role of language is an absolute prerequisite of all that, of our current situation, with its pros and its cons. Now, and of course, this element of language is naming. But Lao Tzu cautions against overdoing it. I think what he's recognising there is that language isn't inscribed on the universe. And this is why the Tao is ineffable. We can't exhaust the universe with names or propositions or sentences. The universe doesn't speak Chinese. It doesn't speak Sanskrit, as some people seem to think, or ancient Hebrew, as some other people seem to think, or classical Arabic, as some other people seem to think, or biblical Greek, you know, New Testament Greek, as some other people seem to think. It doesn't speak human language. Human language is an artifact. And the names that we give to things are the names of entities that we ascribe to the flux of existence itself. In other words, when we name something, we also make it into an identity, into a separate thing with a boundary. It's the naming that does that, not the universe which does that, and the names pick that out. The universe is an unformed cloud. It's a cloud that has no shape. We put the shapes into it. On what basis do we put the shapes into it? On the basis of what's useful to us. You know, after the famous thing, Sapir-Whorf's talk about Eskimos or Inuit peoples recognise, I don't know what it is, 15 types of snow. But you recognise one type of snow. Well, I have a use for that knowledge, you don't. One word's good enough for you. In their context, they live amongst the snow. They need to be able to distinguish hard, compact snow from powdery snow, and so on.
Yeah.
So he's actually kind of pointing that out. And it's a bit of rarefied philosophy that can make hell of a lot of a difference to the way things pan out for particular societies. Strangely, it's so kind of rarefied and abstruse, I doubt anybody's following what I'm talking about now.
I'm following it.
Yeah.
I'm with you. I'm with you on it.
Cool. The nub of it is that he's allowed to, he's putting it to us that language isn't inscribed in the universe. The universe doesn't speak Chinese or English or a human language. The universe speaks its own language. But nevertheless, our languages work. And that's precisely why they develop and evolve and continue. It's because they work for us. He's a bit of a pragmatist. He's pragmatism, really. He's a kind of pragmatist. So this, I think, is actually amazing. Why is it wisdom to know when you've got enough names? Well, if you get kind of so carried away with making distinctions, that the language would cease to function. He's asking us to remember its functional nature. I mean, at a very sort of prosaic level, it might be, he's talking, it's a bit like, you know, the campaign for clear speech. You know, there's a kind of reaction against the way insurance policies are written. Or the way some French philosophers can get carried away with amazingly convoluted sentences that completely bamboozle you and maybe don't say anything. People begin to suspect that they don't say anything. So a sort of a care with language and an eye to its utility is something that he's talking about there. And because he takes that view, unlike some people think the universe does speak a human language, or it speaks logic, or it speaks maths, which are languages, ultimately. But if that were the case, you could exhaust the universe descriptively with sentences or propositions or mathematical statements with no reminder. For Lao Tzu, there's a reminder. This is Nietzsche versus Aristotle. Yeah. Lao Tzu would be with Nietzsche. There is a reminder. There's an ineluctable more. However much we say, there's always more. Which is why he says that the Tao has no name. It is a cloud that has no shape. Keep that in view and you won't get carried away with the hubris of imagining that human language is inscribed into the universe. And this is an issue I take with Sanskritists, you know, who think the universe speaks Sanskrit. I think that is a little bit of self-congratulation by nationalists. You know, it's a language, it's a very noble language and all the rest of it, and it's got a wonderful technical vocabulary for yogis and people of that type. But nevertheless, it's a human language, is what I would be wanting to say about that. And I'm very pleased that I'm on the same side as Uncle Lao. Yeah. At the beginning of time, returning to the text, at the beginning of time, the sage gave names to everything, seen and unseen. Well, it's just imagining some point when language emerges and there's a sagacious person walking around saying, well, we'll call this a grain of sand, and this is a wheat seed, and this is a guard dog, and this is a cloud, and this is a fluffy cloud, and this is a green tree, and this is a lighter green tree, and so on. And it's just this kind of picture of the beginning, you know, that our beginnings are in something actually very felicitous. That the names that we inherit and that we use that help us to survive somehow came out of the operations of a sage, a primordial sage. So even though he's urging this caution about language, he's also telling us that it's a really wonderful thing. He's not knocking it. He's just describing to us very accurately what it is and how it works and why we should celebrate it and why also we should have a caution around it. Which, of course, he's right, you know, language gets used to bamboozle people, doesn't it? Yeah. It gets used to help them to enlighten themselves, but it also gets used to bamboozle them. Rhetoric, you know. The whole operation of so much language is just to bamboozle us. It's to get us to behave in certain ways that are not necessarily in our interest or in the interest of the world. Through rhetoric, which is no regard for truth particularly. It can be true, a rhetorical statement can be true, but it doesn't have to be, because its object is to persuade. Lao Tzu's got all that in these few lines. Anyway, there's the clinching stanza. A ruler who walks the way is like a river reaching the sea, gathering the waters of the streams into himself as he goes. Actually, the ruler who walks the way is the same as the sage who holds to the Tao, or the ruler who follows the Dao faithfully. That is the way. The way is to follow the Dao faithfully, to be informed by the great ineffability at the core of existence and at the core of human consciousness. If we're very honest with ourselves, that's what we find, that there's always more. It's bottomless. It will defy language. It will inspire language of a poetic character, but it will also defy it. It will never be effed. That ineffable will never be effed. Follow that. And of course it means that you're very careful and sceptical about what you claim. You check it out thoroughly. As a safeguard against the excess of language, or against a safeguard against giving too many names. This is what he poetically puts it. If you can manage that, you're like somebody walking towards the sea and the streams all coalesce in you as you get there. And it's as though understanding increases if you follow this way. If you hold to the Tao and realise you can't eff the ineffable, and realise that somehow you've still got to be orientated to it. And perhaps you have the comic duty to try and eff it, even though you never will. And out of that, producing some good for the human communities. And with a full understanding of the nature of language, of its beauty, of its grandeur, but also of a certain sense of limits. So he gathers the waters of the streams into himself as he goes, understanding the world flowing in, the world allowed to flow in, so you can see it and be with it and have an intimacy with it that allows you to understand. And understanding here is posited as a kind of an intimacy with the world, gained through a certain openness to it.
So, wish you were here, but seeing as you're not, I hope you enjoyed the podcast.
Yeah, wash your hands.
And we'll speak to you soon.